Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, October 28th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. A quick reminder before we get into today's conversation about Streetwise Hebrew for the Times of Israel community, our bite-sized audio Hebrew classes. So today we have Ops and Blogs editor Miriam Hirschlag and reporter Amy Spiro. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Amy, let's get started with you because you have a story leading the site right now about the new head of Israel's reform movement, Anna Kaslansky, who fascinatingly grew up secular in Moscow and Russia and discovered Reform Judaism here in Israel as a young adult. What was that conversation like? What did you learn?
Yeah, so she's a very interesting person. She was born in Moscow, as you said, to, you know, very secular parents. You know, most Russian Jews at that time had no choice but to be very secular. She came here when she was about two. And yeah, she grew up in Haifa, you know, no real connection to religion. And then she's working for a nonprofit in her early 20s while she was also studying at the University of Haifa. And she met this Reform rabbi and she said, you know, I didn't realize he was the rabbi. You expect a rabbi to have, you know, a black hat and a suit and a beard. And this one didn't fit the bill. So that was like her first exposure to, right, to Reform, interaction with anyone Reform. And then a few years later, she was getting married and she really didn't want to go through the traditional route in Israel, which is obviously through the Rabbanut, through a state approved rabbi, which are all Orthodox. And so she ended up, her DJ actually introduced her to a Reform rabbi who ended up,
that's great,
officiating at the wedding. And 20, 25 years later, she's now the head of the Reform movement in Israel. She took over as the acting head when Rabbi Gilad Kariv, who led the movement for a dozen years, was elected to the Knesset earlier this year. So she's coming into the job now officially, you know, about 2 months in now.
So what's her agenda about? Obviously, it's very big shoes that she's filling, which you write about. Is her agenda essentially following what Kariv has been doing for the last dozen years, or does she also have some new directions that she wants to take? Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done.
Right. Yeah, she's definitely, you know, she worked with Kariv for the past decade and she definitely believes in what he's doing and wants to continue a lot of that. So, you know, and she also, she headed the movement's congregational arm for the past decade. And they've seen, you know, a doubling in the number of congregations, Reform congregations in Israel. So that's something they're looking to improve. And they're also always fighting, you know, legal battles for recognition in Israel. It took a long time before any Reform rabbis were able to receive any state funding the way that some Orthodox rabbis in Israel do. And that was like a 2012 ruling. And even still today, the funding for that does not come through the religious services ministry the way that the funding for all Orthodox rabbis come. The religious services ministry gives the money to the culture ministry, and the culture ministry gives that money to the rabbis because the religious services ministry refuses to say, we will
have
fund
anything to do with
Reform rabbis. Mm-hmm. So there's always court battles. I mean, earlier this year, they had a big ruling on conversions, you know. So, and Anna also very much wants to focus on youth, as makes sense when looking towards the future. So they have youth movements and things like that. And she believes that's a very important focus to get people when they're younger to feel an affiliation and to grow those bonds with the movement.
Amy, you wrote that this sentence caught my eye, that she splits her, she shares her office with Anat Hoffman of Women of the Wall. And I thought, okay, how is that working? This is like, you kind of need to have your own office when you're the head of the Reform movement in Israel. Can you delve into that a little bit more?
Yes. You know, it was funny. I walked into her office to meet her and the whole office is like covered in photos of Anat Hoffman being arrested, and they have like her bib from prison with her prison number. And I was like, okay, I can understand why, you know, you might have one or two photos of Anat Hoffman getting arrested. It's obviously connected to the movement overall. But I was like, this is a lot of photos of Anat Hoffman getting arrested. And then when we sat down, she said, we're actually sharing this office, basically like half of the, you know, she sits now in Hebrew Union College, and kind of half of their offices were connected to Beit Shmuel, which is like right behind there. But the whole facility closed during COVID. And so there wasn't really access. So she also lives, fairly north. She lives in Eben Yehuda. So she works sometimes from home, sometimes from offices in Tel Aviv, and sometimes in Jerusalem. So they sort of pick the days where they're sharing. And, you know, in these days of remote work and everything, I think they're right. making it work. But I think they're also hoping that those offices will reopen soon.
Those are some strong women sharing a space.
That's
I like that.
For sure.
This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sacks, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's KORENPUB.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
This dovetails interestingly, Miriam, with a couple of the blogs that you wanted to talk about today, starting with that one that's getting a lot of play about a couple. Well, a half Israeli couple whose marriage abroad is not being recognized here. If you want to unpack this for us, it's a complicated story.
Let me drill it down. But, you know, it's so interesting because Anna Kislansky was part of a wave of Aliyah that came in the beginning of the 1970s from what was then the Soviet Union. And this is a piece by a woman named Maria Verbova, who immigrated to Israel with her mother in 1991, part of a major wave of immigration from the former Soviet Union that year. So they are really women from two generations of these very, very significant and impactful waves of immigration that changed a great deal about the fabric of Israeli society, and also, of course, challenged the question of Jewish identity in the country and also our legal system. So Maria Verbova writes a piece called Forced to Leave Israel by the Rabbinate and Interior Ministry. She's an Israeli citizen. She's registered with the Interior Ministry as being Jewish. And like 42% of all Jewish Israelis, she leads a secular life. She's a biologist and a chemist. Her husband, Thomas, also a scientist, is a British citizen who's not affiliated with any religion. That's how she described it. So they met and fell in love while Thomas was in Israel for postdoc research at the Weizmann Institute. And they couldn't get married in Israel because Israel lets citizens marry only through religious institutions. That's one of the reasons Gilad Kariv is sitting in the Knesset today to tackle these difficult situations and laws. And the rabbinate, you know, so you know, if you're Jewish, you get married through the rabbinate. If you're Muslim, it's through the Islamic authorities, and you're Christian through the church. There's no civil marriage here. So the usual option would be for Verbova and Thomas to go abroad and get married. A lot of weddings in that category take place in Cyprus because it's just a hop, skip, and a jump. But what do you do in a pandemic when travel is so restricted? So the two discovered that the state of Utah recently started offering to perform marriages via secure teleconference. And that's what they did.
Unreal.
Mm-hmm. So they got married over the internet through Utah. They had a marriage license, Mazel Tov. Only Israel has refused to recognize any of these Utah marriages. And Thomas couldn't get his visa extended. And the couple left Israel. They now live in Denmark. So Verbova writes that her departure from Israel has put her and her mother under incredible strain, right? She's only child, only parent that came together, and has forced her to choose between her mother and her husband and finding herself in a new country without the social and familial connections they enjoyed in Israel. Her case, together with several other couples, is going through the courts in terms of recognizing the Utah marriage.
That's what I wanted to ask about. Because the Utah marriage, she seemed to refer to the fact that some of the Utah marriages had been recognized, or did I misunderstand that?
I think it had to do with who was pulling the strings and making the decisions at the time. And remember that we went through during the pandemic to add to the turmoil of our lives. I shouldn't speak in the pandemic in in past tense. But in terms of, you know, being in a serious lockdown, we went through four governments, and at various times, different officials were making very quick and impactful decisions about people's lives. And Arye Dery was, you know, in charge when she was Arye Dery of Shas, who would obviously oppose anything that seems to challenge the structures of marriage, Jewish marriage in a country. So it fell between the cracks with other couples, and that's going through the courts. But it really touches on a painful situation for many Israelis. And the power of her piece is that it shows how policy drills down, I think, into people's lives, and they have to make decisions. And, you know, so I think it's maybe easy to think, oh, well, they're not religious, they can't get married, but it's okay. They'll live together because, you know, it's not that important to them, which isn't actually something for anybody to say. It's only the people can say what's important to them. But I think in your mind, in the minds of many Israelis, they can sort of wash over it and look away from it. But the idea that this couple, by the way, a kind of, in terms of professionally, a power couple, obviously of great value to Israel's economy, not that that should matter, is now living in Denmark as a result of what seem to be laws that fall right into that difficult spot of Israel as a Jewish and democratic society, where the weight has tipped towards adhering to Jewish law rather than giving every citizen a fair shake or an equal shake. And this is, you know, this is her reality. Come some third rail issues here that are now being played out. And I think that we get back to the Knesset and we get back to the rise of, you know, reform Judaism. Not that she's a reformed Jew, but this is, you know, reform Judaism was, reforming is literally an insult in Israel. So, you know, now that with a Knesset member, you know, from the head of the movement, we are seeing some very interesting historic changes.
Right. I mean, obviously, it's sort of amazing that in where are we 2021, that we really have moved forward in this situation. And yet, oh my goodness, you know, it's like for every step forward, 10 steps back, or three or five.
And also, I think it's a long-term problem. She was a child in 1991 when she arrived with many, many, many thousands of other Jews or people who were connected and not halachically Jewish. The issue, everyone has known that it was coming, that a generation of people were gonna grow up alienated. And on top of that, there were no convenient, or this is not about her case, but in the general sense, no one came up with a particularly good solution for conversion. They weren't welcomed. If you talk to people, Russian, Israeli citizens from the former Soviet Union today, they will talk about the kind of slings and arrows of their experience being here. And I think it's a real reckoning now as they gain political power in Israel.
Right, Amy, I'm just curious if Anna Kozlansky, if you spoke about that aspect of it at all, as her Russian background, her position as a, you know, first a secular Jew who came from Russia and then discovered the reform movement. Did you get into that at all?
No, we didn't specifically talk about issues of marriage. You know, obviously, you know, what the reform movement obviously wants its own weddings in Israel to be recognized by, you know, the Interior Department, which they're obviously not. You know, that doesn't particularly apply in this case. You know, but they're always fighting, as I said, you know, they're constantly fighting all these legal battles, and they have an entire arm of the movement, you know, the Israel Religious Action Center, which is always, you know, going to the courts, and it's a very slow process in the courts here, and it can often be a very slow process. And, you know, the Supreme Court often will turn around and say, we want the Knesset to deal with this issue, and that takes even more time. So, it's definitely something, you know, definitely something that the reform movement supports, you know, issues of civil marriage and things like that. It's not something specifically Anna and I discuss in terms of her own background.
But it's certainly out there. And finally, Miriam, you have a few blogs and writing and op-ed writing about the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whose one-year Yahrzeit is being marked now. People who, you know, were his students and followed him and followed his writings. It's some lovely writing that you have there.
Right. I mean, the one-year anniversary of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' death really prompted a great many articles about him and tributes to him on most Jewish media platforms. Lord Rabbi Sacks was the former chief rabbi of the Commonwealth. That is what had once been the British Empire, and had a global status as a profound and influential thinker, writer, speaker on the world stage with numerous books, articles, lectures. His influence was tremendous, and his passing at the age of 72 last year was felt by his many admirers as a painful and premature loss. I thought to point out two featured blog posts involving Rabbi Sacks that I think together show something about how a figure like him becomes part of collective memory. And the first post is by Dr. Michal Biton. She's a scholar in residence at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. She's also the communal leader, Rosh Kehillah, of a synagogue in New York City called the Downtown Minyan. Her piece is a tribute to Rabbi Sacks that is full of personal experiences of interacting with him when he lived in New York City starting in 2013. Biton relates numerous examples of how she observed firsthand as Rabbi Sacks used wisdom and compassion to support struggling rabbis, to serve as a mentor, to champion women as Jewish leaders, very human gestures, including the time he called her at the hospital after she'd given birth. And it's a lovely personal portrait that illuminates Rabbi Sacks' belief in the importance of individuals. And for me, the post like that represents the voice of those who knew him firsthand. And then the second post is by Rabbi Francis Nataf, and it's about Facebook in the wake of the whistleblower's revelations about the toxic influence of Facebook algorithms on society. And this essay argues against blaming the algorithms for our toxic culture. And the post references an idea from Rabbi Sacks that moral thinking, moral decision-making belong in the realm of the individual and community and not in business or government. So here you have not so much Rabbi Sacks, the person, but rather Sacks as a set of teachings, teachings that are being enlisted to make a case. And it just strikes me that this is the natural transition. You know, plenty of people will remember their personal encounters with Rabbi Sacks for many years to come, but so many more people, and obviously more and more as time goes on, will encounter Jonathan Sacks only through the writing and recordings he left behind, and they are impactful, and I think he will become part of the canon of Jewish voices, and I will say personally, Yehi Zichro Baruch. It was really great to be able to publish these pieces, and I'm sure we have had and we will continue to have his memory preserved on the, you know, in the big conversation that is the blogging platform.
Thanks to you both for being here this morning. We will be back again with Daily Briefing on Sunday. Just that reminder for Streetwise Hebrew, become a member of the Times Israel community at our website if you'd like to sign up for those classes. In the meantime, have a good Thursday and a good weekend, and Shabbat Shalom from us.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.